Imagine trying to freeze an explosion midair, just hitting pause.
Right, where all that chaotic energy, all the flying fragments are just totally locked in place.
Exactly, just suspended in time. I mean, it sounds like a special effect from a sci-fi movie, but metallurgists actually do exactly this on a microscopic level.
They do, yeah. And by manipulating this sort of frozen explosion, engineers can take ordinary materials and make them, well, practically invincible.
Which is wild. So for today's deep dive, we're looking at a study from 1988 by researchers Adamert and Padacia from the Institute of Metals. And they were studying something called hard-facing alloys.
Yeah, and to really picture where these alloys are used, I want you to imagine standing next to a massive tunnel boring machine, like the ones grinding through solid granite,
Oh, whoa, okay.
or, looking at the steel teeth of an industrial rock crusher. The metal in those machines takes just an absolute beating.
I can imagine. Continuous friction, impact, just gnarly conditions.
Exactly. So hard facing is this process of welding a super tough, highly specialized metal coating directly onto those surfaces to stop them from being just totally chewed apart.
And the 1988 study, it focuses on how scientists optimize these specific coatings by adding surprisingly common and very cheap ingredient, which is silicon.
Right. But before we get to the silicon, we really need to set the baseline, right? We have to look at the material they were starting with.
Okay, let's unpack this. The researchers started with an iron chromium carbon alloy.
Yes, the standard FCRC system.
Right, and to visualize what this looks like, say, under transmission electron microscope, you should think about Rocky Road ice cream.
I love this analogy so much.
It works so perfectly because you have these large, really hard chunks, Sullen ice cream, that's the nuts and the frozen marshmallows, and they're floating around in a much softer, mixed-up base of chocolate ice cream.
Right, and in our baseline metal alloy, those hard nuts are what we call primary M7C3 carbides.
Okay, wait, let's break that down. M7C3.
Yeah, the terminology is actually super helpful here. The C is obviously carbon, but the M stands for metal.
So it's not just pure chromium making up those hard chunks.
Exactly. It's an M, not a CR, because it's a mix of metal atoms. It's mostly chromium, but you've got iron and other substituting atoms that are structurally locked together with the carbon.
Okay, got it. So that's the nuts. What about the chocolate ice cream base?
The base is an austenite matrix. Austenite is just a specific phase of iron where the atoms arrange themselves in a face-centered cubic lattice.
And the researchers call this base a eutectic matrix, right?
Yes, eutectic,
Then.
which simply means that during the cooling process, the liquid metal hits a very specific temperature and just simultaneously freezes into two distinct solid phases at the exact same time.
Right, so it's a mix of that austenite and some smaller carbides. But what happens to that austenite base as it cools is where things get really strange.
It does. It gets fascinating.
Because the study points out that the austenite is essentially configurationally frozen.
Which is such a great term, configurationally frozen. And the physics behind that dictate literally everything else that happens in this metal.
So how does it get frozen like that?
Well, when this alloy is deposited during an industrial weld, it goes on as this glowing hot liquid. And as it cools down, the atoms naturally want to shift around. They want to migrate and settle into a nice, relaxed, thermodynamically stable arrangement.
Which makes sense. Everything wants to be stable.
Right.
Yeah.
But moving around inside a solidifying metal requires a process called reconstructive diffusion.
Reconstructive diffusion,
Yeah.
meaning they have to rebuild the structure.
Basically, yeah. The atoms have to physically break their bonds, travel through the crystal lattice, and rearrange themselves. And doing that takes thermal energy.
Yeet.
Exactly. But right around 1150 degrees Celsius, the cooling happens so incredibly fast that the thermal energy just vanishes.
Wow. So the atoms literally run out of time and energy to move.
Yes, they hit a complete wall, the temperature drops, their mobility just plummets, and they get trapped wherever they happen to be standing when the music stops.
Like a microscopic game of musical chairs.
Perfectly said. The structure becomes thermodynamically unstable-like. It really, really wants to change into a different state, but it just lacks the energy to do it. It's trapped in a metastable state.
Okay, so why does this frozen state matter to you, the person listening to this deep dive?
Right. What's the point?
We are looking at a material held in suspended animation. The atoms were trying to form one equilibrium structure, the clock ran out, and they got locked into an entirely different configuration.
And the absolute genius of the Adamert and Padacia study is how they figured out a way to manipulate that paused system.
But testing a paused system under those conditions presents a pretty massive logistical problem, doesn't it?
Oh, huge. Because the real-world industrial method used for hard facing is manual metal arc welding.
Which is not exactly a delicate lab procedure.
No, it's incredibly violent, it's messy, it's highly variable. You simply cannot systematically study the precise atomic role of an additive like silicon by looking at a chaotic industrial weld.
Right, you'd never know what caused what.
Exactly. So the researchers needed a pristine, highly controlled laboratory substitute to model that exact same microscopic architecture.
So what do? They created these 65-gram experimental casts in the lab.
Yep, tiny little casts.
They took high-purity elements, melted them down in an argon arc furnace, and then cooled them in a water-cooled copper mold.
The setup there is really intentional. The argon gas is crucial because it pushes out all the ambient air, it prevents atmospheric oxygen from contaminating the melt and just totally ruining the internal chemistry.
And the water-cooled copper mold.
Well, copper is an exceptional thermal conductor. It pulls the heat out of the liquid metal incredibly fast.
Ah, so it's simulating the rapid temperature drop of a real weld hitting a giant piece of cold steel. Okay, but wait a minute. I have to push back here.
Let's hear it.
A water-cooled copper mold is going to suck the heat out way faster than a standard industrial welding torch just moving across a surface.
It is, yeah.
So if this whole structural system depends on the exact speed of cooling to freeze the atoms in place, doesn't a faster cooling rate mean we're freezing them at a totally different point in the timeline?
That's a really sharp observation.
Right. Like, are we even looking at the same material at that point? Doesn't that fundamentally break the comparison?
It's a valid concern, and this raises an important question about lab models. But it doesn't break the model, it just shifts one specific variable.
Okay, how's...
Because the lab cast cools faster, you're right, the atomic mobility shuts down sooner. Which means the structure becomes configurationally frozen at a slightly higher temperature than the real-world weld.
Got it.
And at that higher temperature, the equilibrium state is a bit different. Specifically, the rapid freeze traps a higher concentration of expensive chromium inside the austenite.
Inside the ice cream base.
Exactly. More chromium gets stuck in the background matrix than you would typically see in a slower cooling industrial application.
Okay, so we end up with slightly different chromium levels.
Right. But the essential part of the researchers' validation is what happens next. They used optical micrographs and microanalysis to prove that, aside from that one slight shift in chromium concentration, the physical architectures are virtually identical.
Oh, wow. So the primary M7C3 carbides still form the exact same way?
Yes. The eutectic mixture behaves the same way. It proves that the complex, chaotic phenomena of a heavy industrial weld can actually be accurately simulated and decoded in a lab.
As long as you mathematically account for the variables you are shifting.
Exactly.
Okay, so we have a validated model, but we also have a glaring problem. We've got this highly valuable, super hard chromium getting trapped uselessly in the ice cream base.
Right, it's just sitting there doing nothing.
And the austenite base isn't even permanent. The paper points out that when this metal is subjected to high heat in a real-world industrial setting, that metastable austenite is eventually going to decompose into low chromium ferrit anyway.
Yes, it's a doomed matrix.
So any chromium sitting in that matrix is entirely wasted. It's literally going down with the ship.
Exactly. We need an element that forces the chromium out of the matrix, and crucially, we need it to be cheap.
Enter silicon, the budget reallocator.
Yes. Silicon is abundant, it's budget-friendly, and in various alloys, it's already known to enhance oxidation and corrosion resistance at high temperatures.
So they decide to add it in.
Right. The researchers really wanted to observe the internal structural mechanics when they flooded this specific iron-chromium-carbon alloy with silicon.
And what's wild is that during the solidification process, the silicon does not disperse evenly at all.
No, it strongly partitions.
It actively avoids the hard M7C3 carbide chunks. It just floods straight into the austenite matrix.
Which is amazing to see. The study actually recorded silicon concentrations up to 18% atomic concentrated exclusively within the austenite.
18%. It behaves like a bouncer at a club, just corralling all the silicon atoms into the matrix and keeping them completely out of the carbides.
I love that. And what's fascinating here is the mechanism behind that partitioning. It really just comes down to structural incompatibility.
Like they just don't fit.
Literally. Silicon atoms simply do not fit well into the crystal lattice of those hard M7C3 carbides. It is the atomic equivalent of trying to force a square peg into a round hole.
That's what happens.
As the carbide crystal grows and forms its rigid structure, it physically pushes the incompatible silicon atoms out of the way. It rejects them into the remaining liquid pool, which, as we know, eventually freezes as the austenite matrix.
But by flooding into the austenite, the silicon actively reduces the amount of chromium that's allowed to stay in that base.
Exactly. It's extreme budget reallocation.
Because chromium's best possible job, its highest and best use, is to form those super hard M7C3 carbides, the armor of the metal.
Right.
If we add cheap silicon to fortify and protect the matrix, the silicon effectively evicts the chromium from that dead-end job in the austenite. It fires it.
It does. It fires the chromium and forces it to go where it's actually useful.
It forces it to build more armor.
Exactly. You are utilizing a low-cost additive to force your most expensive resource to do its actual job. The presence of silicon changes the whole thermodynamic balance of the matrix, pushing the chromium out to form more of the primary carbides.
Okay, reallocation is great, but here's where it gets really interesting. Because silicon doesn't just act as a chemical accountant, moving elements from one column to another.
No, it does something much more dramatic.
It physically shapeshifts the hardest parts of the metal.
Yeah, the visual evidence in the study's optical micrographs reveals just a total physical transformation.
What does it look like?
Well, if you examine the low silicon baseline alloys, the starting point, the primary M7C3 carbides, those hard chunks, they form as these long, sharp, elongated needles slicing through the matrix.
Okay, so they look like jagged shards of glass embedded in the metal.
Exactly. Very sharp, very pointy. But as the silicon concentration increases, the morphology of those needles fundamentally changes.
The actual shape of them.
Right. The paper explains that silicon causes a decrease in the orientation dependence of the interface energy.
Okay, let's translate orientation dependence of the interface energy into how a crystal actually grows. Because that's a mouthful.
Fair enough. When a crystal forms, atoms attach themselves to the growing structure wherever it requires the least amount of thermodynamic energy, right?
They take the path of least resistance.
Exactly. In the baseline alloy, it costs significantly less energy for the crystal to stack atoms rapidly in one specific direction, and it costs a lot of energy to grow outward sideways.
Okay.
So it favors one orientation, it grows into a long, thin needle.
But then we add the silicon.
Right. When silicon is introduced, it alters the surface chemistry, it levels the energy playing field, making it equally expensive for the crystal to grow in all directions.
Ah, so the silicon forces those sharp, fragile needles to stop growing into long shards and start growing outward uniformly.
Yes. The paper uses the term equiaxed, which basically just means the chunks become rounder, more globular.
So we go from microscopic glass needles to solid metal boulders.
That's a great way to picture it. But, you know, changing a needle into a boulder is visually striking in a microscope. The researchers still needed empirical data to prove that the shape-shifting actually translated to real-world industrial toughness.
Right. Does it actually help the rock crusher?
Exactly. So they designed a highly precise wear test to run these alloys through the gauntlet.
I was wondering about this. How do you definitively prove that your metal boulders are tougher than your metal needles?
You grind them down and measure the loss.
Brutal.
Very. The researchers machined these 5-millimeter diameter cylindrical specimens of the different alloys.
Just tiny little cylinders?
Yep. They applied a specific constant load of 0.43 kilograms to the flat face of the cylinder. Then they pressed that face against a rotating disc.
And what was on the disc?
It was coated in 75-mesh silicon carbide.
Okay, wait. Silicon carbide?
Yeah, which is one of the hardest materials on Earth. It sits just below diamond on the Mohs hardness scale.
Wow. And 75-mesh?
75-mesh means it is essentially extreme industrial-grade abrasive sandpaper.
So they literally just subjected the metal to continuous brutal friction.
Exactly. The disc rotated at a sliding velocity of 0.63 meters per second.
Okay.
And every 10 minutes, they stopped the machine. They weighed the metal cylinder to measure the exact microscopic mass that had been ground away.
To see how much they lost.
Right. Then they renewed the abrasive disc so the sandpaper didn't get dull, and they started again. They ran multiple iterations per alloy to calculate a specific wear resistance score based on the volume of metal destroyed.
Okay, let's look at the numbers they published because they are wild.
They really are.
So alloy S1 is the baseline. It contains only a tiny trace of silicon, like 0.20%. It represents our needle-filled rocky road.
Right, the glass shards.
Alloy S1 went through the grinding test and received a specific wear resistance score of 0.860.
Keep that number in mind, 0.860.
Then we have Alloy S3. This is the variant where they pump the silicon up to 6.90%. The chromium has been evicted from the matrix. The needles have been transformed into boulders.
Yeah, the fully upgraded version.
Alloy S3 goes through the exact same brutal grinding test, and its specific wear resistance score is 0.004.
It's just staggering. The wear drops from 0.860 down to 0.0004.
That is an improvement of over 200 times.
More than 200 times the wear resistance, just from adding silicon.
So what does this all mean mechanically? How does rounding out the internal chunks make the metal virtually invincible to scratching and grinding?
It really comes down to how shapes handle stress concentrations.
Okay, explain that.
Think about it. If you have a long, thin glass needle embedded in ice cream, and you hit that needle from the side with a heavy lateral force, what happens?
It snaps immediately.
Exactly. All the mechanical stress is concentrated on a very fragile geometry. In the baseline metal, when that industrial sandpaper hits those long carbide needles, they crack under the impact.
And once they crack, they're not protecting anything anymore.
Worse than that, actually. Once the needles fracture, the broken shards act as secondary abrasives.
Oh, wow. So they turn on themselves.
Yes. They get dragged through the softer austenite matrix and chew it up from the inside out. The material degrades incredibly rapidly.
But a boulder doesn't snap.
No, it doesn't. Those round equiax shapes created by the high silicon content have no weak directional axis.
They're uniform.
Right. When the silicon carbide abrasive hits the round carbide boulder, the spherical shape just absorbs the impact. It distributes the mechanical stress evenly down into the tough, silicon-fortified austenite matrix below it.
So it's spreading the load out.
Exactly. High silicon alloys prevent the initial microscopic cracking that leads to catastrophic structural failure. They don't just magically resist wear, they fundamentally distribute stress better.
That is brilliant. So if we pull all of this together, we started by looking at a system that was completely configurationally frozen.
Yes, stuck in time.
A microscopic explosion trapped in time with atoms stuck where they didn't really want to be, forming fragile needles and wasting valuable chromium in a matrix that would eventually degrade anyway.
The baseline state was, you know, somewhat functional but highly inefficient and extremely prone to shattering under lateral stress.
But by introducing just a single inexpensive element, silicon, we witnessed this magnificent cascade of mechanical upgrades.
It's a domino effect.
The silicon floods the matrix because it physically doesn't fit in the carbides. It acts as a chemical bouncer, reallocating the expensive chromium back to the front lines to build more armor.
Right.
It alters the thermodynamic rules of crystal growth, rounding out those fragile needles into unbreakable spheres. And the end result is a 200-fold increase in wear resistance.
It's incredible. And honestly, if we connect this to the bigger picture, this study offers a masterclass in optimization that applies far beyond metallurgy.
Oh, for sure.
Because so often, when a system is breaking down under pressure, whether that's a piece of software, a manufacturing pipeline, or even a team dynamic, the first instinct is to just tear it down.
Right, scrap it and build a massive, expensive new system from scratch.
Exactly. We assume the foundational materials themselves are flawed.
We try to invent a completely new alloy instead of working with the one we actually have.
But Adamert and Padacia accepted the frozen, metastable constraints of their system. Instead of overhauling the primary expensive ingredients, they manipulated the internal architecture that was already present.
They optimized.
They did. True innovation is finding the silicon in your own projects. It's discovering that one small, highly efficient, completely unexpected addition that forces all your existing disorganized resources to suddenly align and work together perfectly.
That completely reframes how you can approach any structural problem. Instead of looking at what major components are missing, you look at how the existing components are arranged and ask how a slight tweak to the environment might force them into a stronger configuration.
It changes everything.
So as you look at the projects you are managing right now, consider what forms your foundational austenite matrix, what holds everything together, and what cheap additive could you introduce today that might completely reshape that foundation, reallocating your wasted resources and turning your fragile needles into unbreakable spheres?
That's a great question to ask.
It really is. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep looking for the hidden structures in the world around you, and we will see you next time.